This is new tonight. When we get going, I don't know what to expect. We are anticipating an improvement over the other one, but it may take some adjusting, so please be patient. Everybody can hear, I think. Getting used to, but all of us have, all of us lead different lives. We all have our different situations of work and family and living conditions. But whatever kind of life we're living, each of us, in our own unique way, we can say that life is good. Life is good. No matter how we're living it. And no exceptions. Even when life becomes painful or life becomes difficult, and even when life, the situation in our life seems to be hopeless, like it is now in Texas, even when life seems to be hopeless, life is good. And it's because the true nature of life is beyond this everyday world. The true nature of life is beyond the relative world. We say relative world when we mean this everyday life. And the true nature of our life being beyond the relative world, we can say that inherently life, what we call life, is not some kind of thing, not a thing. Life is not something fundamentally that we can compare to other lives or that we should judge, good or bad. This is not the point. This is our tendency, of course, when we look at our everyday life, compare it or judge it, wish it were different, hope to improve it. But this is not the point of our life. So, the usual idea, particularly in this culture and in the Western world, is that the usual idea is that if we work hard, if we apply ourselves, and if we get some breaks, we get some lucky breaks, that our daily life will be good, you know. But this is a misunderstanding of why we are here. This is a misunderstanding of existence, of our life. In other words, independent of how our everyday life goes, up or down, life is good. So, human suffering exists when we base our life only on our daily activities, only when we see our life in a relative sense. When that happens, our life is at risk of becoming confined and limited. And we may be happy, we may find happiness, but it is conditional. It is a conditional happiness because it is dependent on how we feel the relative world is treating us. That's what makes us happy. Oh, the world treats me really good. The world likes me. Then we're happy. But somebody who may be living exactly the same kind of life as you may say, oh, the world doesn't treat me right. and they suffer. So our happiness is conditional. If we see our life in terms just of how we are day to day in a relative sense. So there is no suffering, and our satisfaction is not conditional when we live our life according to our true nature, our universal nature, Buddha nature. And there is no suffering when we understand the true nature of our relative world, when we understand what's going on with the phenomenon that we encounter in our daily life. When we really understand its nature, there is no suffering. And as our practice tells us, as the teaching tries to help us understand, the stuff of our relative world, the things that we experience every day, day to day, they're temporary, they're transient, they are unsubstantial. And they are what we say in Buddhism, they are empty. This is the nature of the relative things, the phenomenal things of our everyday world. But when we see that, and when we also see that they are not inherently separate, that when we see that we and the things of our everyday world are not isolated from each other, then there is no suffering. It's when we separate things, separate ourselves, become isolated, that suffering can occur. So this is why we practice, to get a glimpse, to get an understanding of the true nature, what's going on in this phenomenal world. Throughout the history of human life, I guess starting with start of this common era, human beings started to think about the meaning of their life, and people came up with various philosophies. These philosophies reflected on the meaning of life, the purpose of life, and presented, in some cases, pretty complicated explanations of what life was. Philosophies developed because it was an effort to see how we should live our life. It was developing philosophies of life was a way to find the truth. What is my life? How should I live it? What is its meaning? And so various philosophies came up, sometimes opposing philosophies. These philosophies were and still are intellectual. Comes from thinking about them, and they are a very rational process of seeing life through rational eyes, coming up with a philosophy. And throughout the centuries, people have come up with very different understandings of what life is by thinking about what life is, and there are a number of disagreements. And sometimes there are conflicts about these disagreements, which, when you think about it, is quite foolish. But that's what happens when we try to understand our life by just thinking about it, by limiting ourselves to a philosophy about it. We run into misunderstandings and we isolate ourselves. But our practice and our way, Buddhism and Zen practice, is to avoid that. To avoid philosophizing about life and writing a very long treatise so that other people could read it. Too much to read, too many philosophies to read. Our way is to let life understand the purpose of life. Our way is to let life live life according to its true nature, not according to some philosophy. So what we do in our practice, what we try to do in understanding our life, is we try to remove the me and the I and the self out of the equation. Get ourselves out of the way if we want to understand what we're doing in this existence. So, in other words, what we really tell ourselves is, don't analyze your life through the eyes of your small mind. Small mind, the mind of the relative world, the ego. Don't analyze your life through the eyes of your small mind. Don't try to understand the meaning of your life with your intellect. If you give up that effort, if you don't worry about that, simply rely on your practice, then there will be no disagreements. It will make no difference what philosophies people have, what different philosophies people have. You won't mind, because you will not be clinging to some philosophy that may disagree. When you don't try to understand the meaning of life with your intellect, there is nothing to debate with anybody. You have no philosophy that you need to put forward to debate. What you have is a mutual and universal silent understanding of your life. Silent. So our practice is about understanding and recognizing the fundamental true nature of our life, which is not based on our own personal view that we develop when we live our relative life. In other words, we avoid at all costs developing a personal view of life based on our desires. This is where we get into trouble. So in our practice, we learn and we understand not to base our life on what we want from life. That's when the suffering begins. So true understanding of life is based on a universal view, not a limited view that resides in the intellect. The universal view of life is a view without limits, There are no boundaries. And we develop that kind of view, that kind of universal view, because we have the opportunity to practice our way every minute. When you first come to Zen practice and are interested in reading about the practice, its history and its, you know, philosophy and the stories, and they're very exciting, they're very interesting. They come from a totally different culture, so they're fascinating. But the literature of Zen practice can be misleading if we're not careful. And if we're not careful, the readings can be misunderstood. Because it can look like our practice is about gaining some kind of individual attainment so that we can have our own individual happiness. I remember when I first started practicing so many years ago and read some books, and I said, oh, this will bring me happiness. And this is a misunderstanding. And it's, I think, because the literature that, when translated from some original Asian writings, translation is difficult, so we misunderstand. So, if you read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the book of Suzuki Roshi's talks, you see that in a number of places he warns against practicing with an idea of attaining something. And the phrase that he developed, that he coined, that we repeat even since 40 years now, he said, have no gaining idea. Do not practice with a gaining idea. Because that will create what is known as karma. Or another way to put it, that will create a spinning mind, a mind that just does this, can't settle down, when we practice with a gaining idea. So we practice simply to let our true nature be aware of itself, for Buddha nature to be aware of Buddha nature. We practice so that Buddha can be aware of Buddha, so that we can know who we are inherently. There is nothing to gain. Already have it. So, this awareness that we have, the awareness that we have, that we try to practice or cultivate in Zen practice, this awareness is not awareness in the usual sense. It's not just a mental awareness. It's not intellectual. The awareness that we have in our practice requires us to set aside the processes of our mind. Go beyond the mind's workings, its spinning nature, its philosophizing tendencies. Go beyond that. This is the awareness we're talking about. And in the literature it's called no mind, no mind. It is Buddha's awareness. It permeates and it saturates our everyday activities because it's already there. This awareness is already inherently there. It means that our true nature, or our Buddha nature, is functioning without inhibitions, without limits. So the practice that we are developing, that we are creating in this culture, Western world, for the last 50 years, 60 years, when this practice first arrived from Asia, Zen practice in the Western world is to express Buddha's activity in our daily life, in each daily activity that we have, working or driving or washing dishes or thinking or whatever we're doing, helping our family. We bring Buddha's activity into each of those daily activities. Buddha mind into those daily activities. And what it really means is we should avoid being casual about each activity, about the activities we do. Let's not be casual about our life's activities, or we will lose the meaning of our life. So if you have a, you know, piece of paper, piece of trash that you'd like to get rid of, and you don't see a garbage pail around, it's not enough to say, oh well, just throw it on the ground. Being so casual with our activities. So in our practice, what we do, the attitude that we have is, if we have a piece of trash, we hold on to it until we come across the proper way to dispose of it that doesn't disturb the environment and doesn't disturb other people. So you will find, as you continue your practice and meet people who have been practicing, you'll notice that they are not casual about what they do. Pretty much paying attention to how they are in the world. And not to leave traces and not to disturb the peace of things. One of the tendencies in our modern world, which comes with many conveniences and many exciting and entertaining things, we are at risk for getting caught up and addicted to all these conveniences. So throw it on the ground because it's convenient. We shouldn't get caught up in rationalizing convenience or rationalizing our comfort, that we deserve convenience or we deserve comfort. And we shouldn't, we have to avoid looking for shortcuts when there's something to do. This may seem beneficial for the moment, but in the long run, it does not lead to any kind of lasting satisfaction with how we lead our life. If we lead our life looking for shortcuts, looking for conveniences, being casual about what we're doing. Our practice is about learning how to be fully engaged in what we are doing. Fully engaged in our activity, and also giving attention to how our activity fits in with where we are and who we are with. So if we are speaking to someone and we see that they are looking at us with attention and acknowledging that they've heard us, we know that we are making a good connection. But if we are speaking to someone and they you know, roll their eyes or look like they want to get away from you. You know that you have to adjust. You have to adjust how you're relating to them if you want to really fit. If you really want to fit, have a good relationship, you have to adapt to their mood. And you have to read their mood by just being there, by being attentive. So we pay attention to how our activity, you know, fits in the situation we're in. We pay attention and we care. We care that it fits, that our words and our actions are accepted with interest. So in our Zazen practice, you know, we breathe in, we breathe out, and there is a pause in between the in-breath and the out-breath. And we keep our awareness on this space of no activity. No in, no out, just pause. Like nothing's going on. We put our awareness there, in that empty space. Because in that empty space, anything can appear. Thoughts, emotions, insights. Anything can appear. So we pay attention. Because each appearance, everything that appears in our life, as small as it may seem to be, as trivial as it may seem to be, each thing that appears in our life is sacred. This is our understanding. So our practice and our activities, we turn all of our activities into jewels. Our practice is to not be casual with our activities, but to turn them into jewels so that people will be pleased. And all activities become an expression of our nature, of our true nature. This doesn't mean, you know, we have to be on, like soldier on guard all the time. It doesn't mean that. It means we relax into what we're doing, just to pay attention and bring some sensitivity to it. So our practice is to let life flow. Let it be constantly changing. Let it be without permanence. Let life be life. And to be cautious not to limit our life with our personal desires. Then all of life is good. Our practice is about expressing confidence. And it starts with the posture we take. So some of you were given instruction tonight in the basic posture of our practice, and some of you have been sitting for quite a while. We start with a balanced posture. And we find the central point. We find a good spot on our cushion so that we feel stable. We start with a balanced posture that is supportive, and that feels whole, wholesome, whole, or integrative. We sit like that, just confident posture. Confident posture and an empty mind. These are the fundamental points of our practice. And we let go of any individual strivings we have or individual ideas we have, and simply put our confidence in our universal nature. We let ourselves feel ourselves in the universal and not as something separate. And the third part of our practice, to find confidence, to express confidence, in addition to the posture and the empty mind, the third element is commitment. Commitment to make our practice continuous and not casual. Not only to do it when it is convenient, but to continue the mind of practice without break. Keep the mind of practice in everything we do, on the cushion or off the cushion. So it is important for us to engage in our life with a confident awareness, independent of our lifestyle. You could be a very, very successful executive, or you could be a school teacher, or you could be the fellow that waits tables. Whatever activity that we engage in our life, we need to engage in it with a confident awareness so that we can be vigorous, energetic, and reflect on what we're doing. So our practice is about expressing our true nature through our everyday activities, whether society judges them as really, really important and high, or sort of modest. Doesn't make any difference. We engage in each activity with confidence. This is how we continue Buddha's awareness. When we proceed with our life in this way, we will never be separated from our true self. And no matter what happens in our life, we are always in charge. If we have that kind of attitude and that kind of practice, even if some big disappointment suddenly comes our way, we are still in charge. We are the boss of our life. When we engage in practice in this way, we will never become the victim of life. And this, I think, is why many people come to this practice, because life is so full of turmoil and disappointments and difficulties, it feels like we're not in control, that we're being pushed around. But with this practice, we're never the victim. So even though we may experience difficult days, difficult times, and even though everyday reality is constantly changing and we have to adapt, if we are aware of the true nature of our life, we're not a victim. And when we're not a victim, we understand how all life is inherently good, no matter what happens. And this is the power of Zazen practice. Does anyone have a question? Yes, please.
So, the practice isn't about happiness, not about finding happiness.
Right.
But practice, we make each thing a jewel, which does sort of sound like happiness to me. And it seems like what comes up is like, is it really that we're saying, don't try to add something to have happiness? Because the minute you do that, you have reversed the practice and you're taking away from it. So I'm trying to understand if it's really sort of a trick we're almost playing on ourselves to say, it really is happiness, but don't think of it like happiness, because then you'll go after it and then you'll destroy it. It is what's already there.
Happiness is something that we apply to ourselves, something that we want to experience personally. When we make each activity a jewel, our orientation is to help everybody else find happiness, not so much ourselves.
That seems really similar to saying that happiness is already there universally.
Yes.
And so my happiness is already there. And it's a matter of taking away the things that cloud it.
Yes.
And so making someone else happy is just like making me happy. So it's like, is that what that means?
Shared happiness becomes joyful. It's when we see happiness as something that we want personally is when we run into problems. If we want to share it universally, equally, not a bigger slice for me, that's beyond happiness. That's joy. And you're correct. It's already there if we get out of our way. Thank you. Cool. Have to go. Yes, please, Dick.
So I'm curious as to what your view is of the, if you can believe the news reports, the mindfulness movement in the U.S., maybe in other parts of the world. It's being commercialized, in my mind, almost weaponized.
Weaponized. Yes. Yeah.
What do you think of that? Mindfulness.
It may be a good starting point to learn to sit quietly and learn to watch your breath and learn to watch your mind and learn to settle down. That's a good starting point. But if we don't take it beyond that, it becomes a technique. A technique to gain something. You know, like stress relief, which is how it all started. You know, I'll do meditation so I will feel better. If we have that idea, it's very limited. Mindfulness practice has to include not just the practice, but an attitude, or a promise or an oath or a vow that says, I'm not going to be overwhelmed by the stuff that comes up in my life. I'm not going to let my emotions overwhelm me. I'm going to pay attention to my mind. I'm going to stay focused. I'm going to do this continuously, not just when I'm in the meditation room. I'm going to continue that through the rest of my day. Without that kind of promise to ourselves, or that kind of vow, you can call it a vow, the meditation that's taking place these days has some limitation. Although it's a good starting point. So we don't know what will happen. Maybe the people who are doing that will evolve the meditation that takes place in some classroom, some corporation. Maybe they will evolve it into something that includes a promise or a vow. We don't know yet. It's a starting point, but we wait and see. Weaponize. Oh, I guess if we're not careful, that could happen. If maybe people get proud, I'm doing mindfulness, you know, and create an ego trip out of the fact that they're doing this thing that they consider to be special, then it becomes a problem. Hopefully that doesn't happen too often, and people will learn to settle down and see the value of continuing mindfulness throughout everything, not just in the meditation room. That's my feeling about it. Thank you. Yes, Anna.
I wondered if being aware of leftover bias and personality, like perhaps procrastination or things about ourselves that can sometimes cloud our beginner's mind is worthwhile, or if that would create the spinning mind that you're talking about, if we can never, with our small mind, really do that.
The spinning occurs when we stay attached. If we become aware of one of our tendencies, if we become aware of it, we simply acknowledge it and then don't make a story about it. So when we stop making these stories, we stop the spinning. But we love stories. We love to make up stories about things that occur in our mind. And some of it's okay. We don't want to be too strict with ourselves. But we should know the limits. And eventually come back to ourself, where we're not becoming attached to our stories. Easier said than done, huh? Thank you. Yes, please.
Yes, you spoke of not getting attached to philosophies or intellectualization in Zen Buddhism. Is there a place for intellectualization or analytic thinking in Zen Buddhism? And if so, when?
There's a place, but that place is not an isolated place. It's not something we do on our own. You know, it can be useful and constructive to be with other people and to exchange intellectual ideas, share our practice, share our feelings, share our thoughts, create community with our friends. And it's that's useful. In fact, it's important, I think, to do that, not to avoid that. It's when we do it solo, without allowing our thoughts and our own intellect to be balanced by what other people are presenting. So if we develop our own point of view and somebody else shares their point of view, it prevents us from taking off, becoming proud of our own point of view. We share it. So there is a place, but there is a place for speaking intellectually, but I think it must be shared. And we have to be careful not to over-intellectualize, or we will become dependent on our intellectual capacity and forget about our heart. Where wisdom resides. But thank you for your question. Umar.
Last, you were talking about commitment. The third point you said was about commitment. And I was thinking commitment is complete and total involvement and engagement, but even bringing that thought into the mind is completely undoes the second thing that you said about the empty mind. So just, you know, it's just doing is what is important then? I'm trying to understand.
Yes. If you're walking by a river and you see someone in the water yelling for help, you don't think about it. Just go. That's the commitment. Ready, ready to act. Ready to be engaged. You don't have to think about it. You know, if we think about it, let's see, should I jump in? She floats away. So we know that you have to act in the moment. This is the commitment. No thinking about it. Thank you.